Michael Graham, New Hampshire Journal, NHJournal.com.
I'm ready, Jack. I'm ready.
Big shocker, right? That editor with NPR talking about inherent liberal bias. Hey, another one. Is Manhattan legal system the only stuff they go after? Is it Donald Trump? Is that the only, are there the only legal cases happening in Manhattan?
If only we could get Donald Trump to start punching women in the face on the subway system, maybe somebody would get arrested for that. Or if we could get Donald Trump to shut down the Brooklyn Bridge during rush hour, maybe somebody would get arrested and punished for that. But the only criminal, apparently, in the entire greater Manhattan area, 12 million people, there's one criminal, and his name is Donald Trump.
That's it. That's it. All there is. All right, Michael, that second congressional district getting quite interesting because the Democrats have a real sort of philosophical battle on their hands between the main people running now for the seat that Ann Custer's held.
And that's what I want to see, is if we're going to see an actual debate. I mean, you know, it's more interesting for people like us, Jack, if you have, you know, candidates who are running on ideas instead of just saying vote Democrat, vote Republican, whatever. You know, Republicans have a lot of ideological fights. You're seeing it, for example, today. There's a bill regarding reporting mental health incidences with gun owners to the federal authorities, and it relates to their ability to, you know, some people call it a red flag bill, whatever. Some Republicans are on one side, some Republicans are on the other, but Democrats are straight down the line. And so in this second congressional district, at this moment where there is a divide in the Democratic Party in the U.S. with the Ilhan Omar AOC folks on one side and the, you know, more traditional Joe Manchin, you know, Democrats on the other, will Colin Van Ostern, the handpicked choice of Annie Custer and the establishment candidate, have an actual idea debate with State Senator Becky Whitley, who has declared herself a progressive? And one reason they might not debate, Jack, is that while Representative Annie Custer keeps calling herself a moderate and keeps calling herself bipartisan, she voted with Joe Biden 100% of the time his first 2 years in office. She's around 96-97% now. She voted against Israel repeatedly since taking office. She voted in favor of the Iran deal. She voted against punishing Ilhan Omar for her anti-Semitic comments. Custer voted against punishing Rashida Tlaib for her anti-Semitic comments. And so New Hampshire Journal, NHJournal.com, we reached out to Whitley and Van Ostern yesterday and said, we want to know, are you with Custer on these votes? And they refuse to answer the questions.
You have another interesting article, Michael Graham. Extremists on the left, not the right, extremists on the left emerging in the Granite State and locally. So this is local, not in Chicago, not New York City, locally. Groups out there over the weekend chanting certain things that basically equate to, obliteration of Israel. On Saturday, there were some folks that basically vandalized the cars of, according to your article in the New Hampshire Journal, Republicans attending the state convention. This is far left stuff, basically calling for, you know, basically death to Israel, almost glorifying the martyrs, but talking about some things that most people have agreed is anti-Semitic behavior. But it's getting more on the violent side. And this is not like Justice Department investigating far right wing groups. This is far left side, almost militant stuff right here at home.
And our own Damian Fisher spoke to a longtime FBI agent who dealt with domestic and international terrorism, Thomas O'Connor, and he said that the trend for violence, the kind of the knee-jerk or the assumption is the violence is on the right. And he says it still exists if you go out to, you know, like, you know, Idaho and some of the, you know, whatever, white identity camps, whatever. But day in and day out, more and more of the political violence in the U.S. and in New Hampshire is on the left. And whether it's the repeated attacks at Elbit Systems in Merrimack, which involved broken windows and setting stuff on fire and trying to chain the doors closed and slinging paint on the employees, et cetera, or whether it's the keying of the cars in Concord the other day, or whether it's the language in these so-called ceasefire resolutions that accuse Israel of atrocities. The head of the Jewish Federation of New Hampshire, the board chair, Tracy Richmond, said in a piece at NHL.com that this rhetoric feeds an already pre-existing, attitude that's, if not people committing violence, people saying, you know what, maybe it's time for violence. I'm gonna say violence is acceptable rather than saying what I should say, which is, even if I agree with you, violence is not the answer. That's the climate that New Hampshire is in right now.
Now, there was, Palestine protesters at the State House in Concord, New Hampshire, denouncing Israel. And, Michael, to you and most people with half a brain, what does from the river to the sea mean? Palestine shall be free from the river to the sea. What does that mean to most people with common sense? What does that saying mean?
Well, to my lovely bride, who is a member of the tribe, she and her fellow Jews will tell you exactly what it means. From the rivers to the sea, Palestine will be free of Jews. And so the plan is to wipe Israel off the map and to go back. And sometimes you'll hear protesters chanting stuff like, no two-state solution, one state, words to that effect. Basically, we're not going to let Israel exist. We want to have an entire map that is all Arab, all Palestine. That's what we want. So it's the end of the nation of Israel. And of course, Israel exists for a very unique reason. It is the place that Jews can go when the world turns anti-Semitic, as it did so horrifically in the 30s and 40s, and some people would argue it's turning again today. So and this is why it bothers me that we have a delegation here in New Hampshire that keeps telling us that they are moderate. But Senator Shaheen was 100% in on the Iran deal and repeatedly voted. She saved it. She helped save the Iran deal. And what happened? Literally, pallets full of cash were delivered to the terrorist mullahs who run Iran. When Trump got out of the Iran deal and put on maximum pressure, Senator Hassan and Senator Shaheen both fought him. They wanted Iran to keep making money. They wanted us to keep transferring money and freeing up funds. They wanted us to integrate the terrorists of Iran into the global community. Biden is back, and Biden's bringing back the same policies because he's a nitwit and just does whatever Obama says. And our own Hassan and Shaheen and Custer and Pappas have all voted with them again and again. This isn't some abstract, what are those knuckleheads down in Washington, D.C. doing? I wish someone would ask Senator Shaheen, do you regret the Iran deal now that you know $350 million went from Iran to Hamas in 2021 alone, and that $350 million, part of it went to build the tunnels that were used for Hamas to carry out their attack on October 7th.
And maybe people should read the covenants of Hamas, their number one goal as an organization is to obliterate Israel. Hey, what happened to the billions of dollars in the prisoner swap that Qatar or Qatar?
So we were told, well, it's okay. That money's only going to go to the humanitarian needs, like bread and medicine. But any idiot knows that as soon as you give the terrorists money for bread and medicine, they take their bread and medicine fund and they send it over to the Hamas and Hezbollah fund. Money is fungible. You can spread it around. There is no such thing as, well, this dollar is protected. Yeah. No, that dollar frees another dollar. And Senator Hassan knows this. She has repeatedly voted to send more money to Iran. Now, maybe she's right. Maybe there's some big grand, scheme where Iran becomes moderate and we have peace in the world and the unicorns all play with the, leprechauns. I don't know. But somebody needs to ask these questions because they will not take the questions from NHJournal.com.
All right, thank you very much. I appreciate Michael Graham and NHJournal.com. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Doug Tengden with an economic look at from WorldMarketAdvisors.com. Doug, before we get into the economy, I thought because one of the shows I watched a little bit last night was that movie, A Walk in the Woods, Robert Redford, Nick Nolte, and it looks like it was actually shot up in Hanover, New Hampshire.
Yeah, right next door to the Co-op food store. It was. I watched that movie a little bit ago too. Great buddy movie for middle-aged guys.
Well,
sorry, Jack.
It's a good story about life, and I like the relationship he had with his wife, and it all ends well. But it was just a good, it was a good fun, good movie. All right, what's not so fun is trying to understand this economy, resiliency, but, and now I'm starting to really question: are we going to see a little bit of a downturn summer and fall more than upturn, especially if the Fed doesn't lower the rates a quarter percentage point, because I know things are still too expensive?
Well, yeah, and you layer on top of that the fuel oil prices and gas prices that we're seeing as a result of the geopolitical tensions, and yeah, you've got a little bit of risk there. But the bottom line is The economy is not going to turn down unless we have some kind of financial pinch. And right now the banks are fairly healthy, despite the higher interest rates pinching bank profits as much as they're pinching consumer wallets.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned geopolitical, and I'm really acutely attuned to what's going on in the Middle East between Israel and Tehran, because the next steps could be actually very concerning to more people. You may think it's far away. Why do you care? Watch what could happen if things escalate, because it affects everything from shipping in the region in terms of getting in and out. It affects energy prices big time. And if Russia ever backstopped Tehran and we do more to support Israel, and who knows what China will do, this thing could change our local market in a pretty quick minute.
Yeah, that's right. And it all it speaks to the economy through the oil price and through gas prices. And this latest escalation between Israel and Iran has the market worried that if things continue to spiral upwards, well, you could see significant increase in oil prices. I would just say on the other side of that, the cooperation between the United States, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, brought about by the Abraham Accords, really was a game changer here. And it had to be humiliating for Iran to launch, 500 missiles and not have one of them land, most of them shot down by air forces. That was really striking. And if Saudi Arabia is involved here, you have to believe that they want to see the global economy be stabilize demand, and so they're going to be responsive in terms of pumping more oil.
What I worry about is Russia getting Tehran, because in Tehran that didn't go over too well. All 350 missiles being shot down by that Iron Shield, that didn't go over too well.
Well, it wasn't just Iron Shield.
I know his allies. I understand.
U.S. guided missile cruisers too.
No, it was big. They didn't do that alone. That was U.S.
Right.
We had other allies and one in the Middle East. My point is, though, that didn't go over well in Tehran. So, regardless of what Netanyahu does, what I worry about is Russia giving them a bigger type weapon that might be able to break through the air defense system.
Sure, and that's what has the market spooked, and that's what has the economy spooked. It's that if you see a significant spike in oil prices, we're thinking 1979 Iran, yeah. Iran revolution sort of thing. Absent that, we see that the U.S. consumer is amazingly resilient. We've had interest rates go up from 0 to 5%, mortgage rates go from 3% to 7.5%. We've seen oil go from $2.50 a barrel to $2.50 a gallon to $3.50 a gallon. We've seen all these things hit the consumer, and yet there's continued job openings, and yet there continues to be strong consumer spending, and yet even European consumers seem to be coming out of their funk. So there's strong consumer demand that keeps underlying the global economy, and that keeps things moving forward.
Do you think the Fed will lower rates a quarter percentage point in June or not?
I don't think so. I think they probably, the way they're talking, I know it's debated, the way they're talking, it looks more like September, because getting inflation down the last mile towards 2 and change rather than 3 and change is proving to be difficult. They're looking at core inflation. Some core inflation is 2 and change, which would indicate, yeah, they could move. But this last mile is being held up by services, and services are being held up by wages. And wages are being pushed up higher by labor demand. And so the Fed's models would say, hold off. And that's why you have all these governors saying, I'm in no hurry. Things are just fine. That's what the Fed seems to be saying with their words. If I look at the numbers, I say, yeah, they should cut. But I think they're going to want to hold off. They don't want to be Jay Powell does not want to be Arthur Burns and cut rates into an election and see inflation reaccelerate.
All right, Doug Tangdon, I appreciate it. And our friends from worldmarketadvisors.com. Thank you, Doug.
Jack, you have a great week.
You are absolutely correct that national news is dominated by Trump and Biden. And I'm not saying that's not important, but it is definitely one of my pet peeves in the world, if you will, because I get to come on here and tell you about all these hundreds and hundreds of bills that are going through the state legislature that arguably are going to have more of an impact on the daily life of the people tuning in right now to your radio show.
Yeah, I
so
agree.
Definitely happy to dive in there if you want.
Yes, please do.
All right. So we got some public hearings happening this week that are definitely interesting. You and I have talked in the past about the Education Freedom Account, which, refresher for anybody not familiar, it allows students to take the per pupil share of state school spent funding and spend it on private and homeschool expenses. So there are two bills, one in the House and one in the Senate, that are both having public hearings today that would raise the income cap for families to participate in the EFA program. But one of them is also interesting because it would extend the timeline to phase out grants for public schools that would otherwise lose out on funding for these students that are taking the per pupil share and leaving public school, going somewhere else. So that was temporarily put in place to sort of ease this transition and address concerns that this would be, you know, really hurting public schools in the long run. So I think it's interesting that this would extend it from 2026 to 2029, which is a pretty good extension and would change the dynamics. But we'll see how that plays out. It's going to be getting a public hearing in the House Education Committee. The other bill that's having a hearing in the Senate Education Committee would just increase the income eligibility without extending that phase out at all. So sort of two dueling bills on that same topic. Other interesting bills that are coming out this week also related to firearms. One that has been sort of slipping under the radar that I think might be interesting to employers in particular, it would prohibit employers from inquiring about or searching for firearms in an employee's vehicle. So they could say, we are not allowed to have firearms on our property, but they couldn't ask or stop someone if they had a vehicle locked in their car. And then if an employer receives public funds, so think of a hospital maybe, they wouldn't be allowed to even have a policy that says you can't have firearms in your locked vehicle. So that's it's a little bit of a sort of lesser known issue, I'd say, in all of our conversations about firearms. I haven't seen this come up, and it's that really interesting intersection between, all right, what are the rights of a private employer versus an employee who, you know, has a firearm and their rights to have a firearm versus, so it's sort of that interesting tension between different rights. And then also today, so that's in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Also in the Senate Judiciary Committee is the bipartisan bill that would report some mental health records to the National Background Check System. And supporters say this is closing a loophole, basically, that New Hampshire should be reporting if someone was ordered to surrender their firearms and committed to a mental health facility. That should end up in the National Background Check System. And then it does also include a way to for a person to apply to have that information removed from the background check system if they are no longer a danger to themselves or others. So that bill, as I said, bipartisan, generally broad support, but there are some detractors who argue that still, you know, that this is just an infringement on Second Amendment rights and it's not going about it in the right way. And then one more, because it's also happening today, and I just think it's some people might be into it. It's reduces the requirements for vehicle inspection. So, for example, it would allow a car to pass inspection if a cracked mirror or headlight is sealed with automotive lens tape, things like that, just sort of easing up those requirements a little bit. And it seems like one step towards easing up New Hampshire's inspection requirements, because every year it seems there's a bill to lessen those requirements, make them every other year, get rid of them for new cars, something like that.
Well, Anna, a full list of things that are not Biden and Trump. Thank you, Anna Brown, CitizensCount.org, CitizensCount.org. Thank you, Anna.
My pleasure.
Google workers protesting Israeli ties on a contract with the Israeli military. Google employees not too happy about it. Aaron Real, NBC News Radio national correspondent. Good morning, Aaron.
No, not happy about it at all. So this is an interesting turn of events that we're seeing today, Jack. There are Google and Amazon workers today taking part in this No Tech for Apartheid campaign. They're going to stage a walkout at the company's headquarters in Sunnyvale, California, Seattle, Washington, and New York City. They're doing them simultaneously, 2 p.m. in New York, 11 in California and Washington. But the workers are planning, quote, militant action. Jack, I have never seen this in a press release, but they say that they're planning militant action in an effort to escalate their demands that Google and Amazon drop this $1.2 billion cloud computing contract that they have with the Israeli military and government. We are allowed as American citizens to peacefully protest. It is our right, and it is a great right, and it should be exercised. But I have never seen a campaign actually use the term militant. Oh. They also say they expect organizers are expecting this to be fairly confrontational today.
Well, you know what? We'll see if the Justice Department responds accordingly. Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, we will. Thank you.
Mike Cody, editor of New Hampshire Business Review and New Hampshire Magazine, and love having Mike on. But Mike, I think you got to be at that luncheon. A good friend, he was on the show that morning, Rick Kaiser from the Navy SEAL community, big leader for the Navy SEAL, the museum down in Fort Pierce, and the one they're doing on the West Coast. Great part of Swim with a Mission. And Rick, I've gotten to know over the years, and what a humble, wonderful person he is. So long in the Navy SEAL community, more than 20 years in the SEAL Team 6 community, and just very humble, humble giant of a guy. But his book, of course, Stories of a Frogman. But he spoke at a business luncheon and a Boys and Girls Club luncheon, and I think you got to hear his talk.
Yeah, you know, he was so inspiring, and you know, his talk went on much longer than what I focused on, but I kind of zeroed in on what it takes to become a Navy SEAL, and what Hell Week is like. And I was thinking about that this morning. I was running, you know, doing a short 2-mile run in the sun, and I had to stop once because I was a little out of breath. I thought, well, I can stop because I'm not training to be a SEAL. If I was training to be a SEAL, you're done, right? You can't quit. And he talked about how difficult that week is and how everybody that's pushing you on, they're trying to get you to quit because they want to make you as tough as possible so you're not going to quit on the battlefield. And very impressive. Well, only 25% of people completed.
Yeah, he's about as tough as they come, and he probably told the audience that, you know, he came close to tapping out of butt school until they told them all to get back in the water and get cold again. Then he got mad.
and he said, you know, they keep changing during this this hell week. You're getting very little sleep, and they have rotating shifts of you know, people who are commanding these drills. And he says, you hope you get a nice one. I thought, I don't think any of them are nice, right? They're pushing you to your extreme, and seeing how many will fall down. But he's very modest and talked about all the great work that
modest is what he is, and he's such a wonderful. He's got a great sense, very dry sense of humor, but wonderful person, Rick Kaiser. He'll be coming up, of course, with our Swim of the Mission stuff, and of course our Tuna Open later in July. We're doing on the Seacoast. Let's switch gears. By the way, I just want to put a plug in for Rick's, the National Navy SEAL Museum down in Fort Pierce, Florida. If you get a chance, Fort Pierce is a pretty near Vero Beach, fly to Orlando. A great, great museum to see and spend almost a half day or a day there. It's wonderful. There's so much real stuff in there. A lot of the retired SEALs or former SEALs are working the museum. But it's just a wonderful place to go visit and understand so much about the Navy and history. And they're trying to get one open on the West Coast, so we support that. Mike, what about driving on the roads? There's another interesting article about how many drivers are out there, especially recently. And don't tell me, because a week ago, Monday or so, whenever that total eclipse was, I think it was overrated. But whenever it was, I saw speaking of highways being packed, I'd never seen traffic like that on Sunday and Monday and even Tuesday morning. Take it away, Mike.
Yeah, and nobody's going 100 miles an hour during that scenario. Paul Brand, who does some work for us from New Hampshire Business Review, spent some time talking with New Hampshire State Police Lieutenant Christopher Storm. And, you know, something that started during the pandemic, people driving very fast because the roads were largely empty, has kind of continued post-pandemic. And he says that, you know, people aren't just, they're getting to stop you people not just for going 90 miles an hour, but over 100 miles an hour, and they're seeing it every day. So they're starting to crack down on that for safety reasons, obviously. In 2023, they made more than 3,000 stops, 89 for people going more than 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you just imagine being a trooper and you stop someone for going 115 miles per hour on 93 or 101 or 95. And, you know, if it's not a medical emergency or something else, they could write a book on the excuses, I imagine. Oh, I had no idea. I had no idea I was going over 100.
Yeah, 10 people were ticketed last year for driving 110 to 120 miles an hour. So, yeah, you're going to be sleeping at the switch there. So that's, you know, and it's an issue that will affect insurance rates in the state. All those factors go into what people pay, but mostly more important than anything else is just the safety of people driving that fast on the roads. And the state's trying to work on that to get people to change their behavior a bit.
All right, good stuff. Mike Cody, thank you very much. New Hampshire Business Review, New Hampshire Magazine. Thank you, Mike.
Hey, thanks a lot, Jack. Take care.
Rory O'Neill, NBC News Radio national correspondent. I talked at length earlier on why my concerns of what really is going on in the Middle East in terms of what may happen next after the missile attack on Israel, even though the Iron Shield with some allies in the U.S. and others was able to knock down 350 missiles, hard to believe. But I'm sure that didn't go over very well in Tehran. So I'm worried about what's next, as well as what Netanyahu and Israel may do or may not. Plus, we have a lot of debate here at home. It's getting emotional, and actually it's getting militant, even right here in New Hampshire as well as Chicago. Rory O'Neill, NBC News Radio national correspondent. Good morning, Rory.
Yeah, good morning, Jack. We saw those demonstrations in big cities like New York and San Francisco yesterday. Now there's a lot more wrangling on Capitol Hill, as it looks like Speaker Johnson's proposal is to take that aid bill and break it down into four parts, one for Israel, one for Ukraine, one for Taiwan, another a bit of a catch-all for GOP security priorities, I think they call it. But overseas, we're all waiting to see exactly how Israel responds to Iran's weekend attack. Apparently, Israel has been signaling to the Biden administration that they will show some restraint, because they too are concerned this will spiral out of control. And don't forget, Israel had been planning to launch its offensive into Rafah in Gaza this week to finally root out Hamas. But instead now they've got this situation with Iran that's still unfolding.
Thank you, Rory. Good stuff. Rory O'Neill, NBC News Radio national correspondent. Glenn Knobloch is an author, and he's written Loons of New Hampshire, Preserving a Natural Treasure. Loons of New Hampshire, Preserving a Natural Treasure. And I want to bring in, and I know Arcadia Publishing and others, but Amazon. Glenn, thanks for being with us. Very important work, and I'm a big fan of Loons. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jack. Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, first, let's start with the home stuff. As I was saying on the show earlier, I came across a good movie later last night. I was just kind of take my mind off A Walk in the Woods, Robert Redford and Nick Nolte, years ago, about a fellow who had written a book, Bryson something, about his half a hike or his hike on the Appalachian Trail. And a lot of it was started right in Hanover, New Hampshire, where they filmed a lot of the movie. So we've had Golden Pond and other things, Glenn, but what about you? Where are you from? Where's home?
Well, my home is Wolfboro, so right near the big lake there, and that's where I get to see my loons, in addition to some local lakes and ponds nearby. And really, this book is a genesis of, I've always been interested in birds and things like that. But, you know, during COVID, when, we all needed a little respite and we are all getting outdoors to get away from being cooped up, I started taking up kayaking and getting close up and personal with loons. And I wanted to know more. And little did I know that right in my backyard, there's a loon Preservation Committee headquarters right over in Moultonboro.
Right.
And, they do outstanding work. So I partnered up with them to write this book. I'm both an author and a historian. So I approached my subject really not only from the physiology of the loon and the call of the loon and the looks of the loon, but also how did the history of that bird evolve in our state from prehistoric times down to the present. And it's a fascinating story that really everyone should know about.
Well, we've had folks on from Fish and Game and the preservation effort you talked about, Glenn. Of course, wonderful place where you live in Wolfboro, on even some of the older fishing gear and some of the lead, smaller, tackle you want to avoid using. But when you wanted to get to know, when you wanted to get up close and personal and learn more about the loon, right, the loons right in your backyard, and you get into kayaking and you get up close, what did you learn? What's in the book? What's special about the loon that we might not order one, other than their majestic, wonderful look, their head perch when they're up in the water, like on high alert, their sound? What did you kind of, what was some things that surprised you as an author and someone looking into writing the book on your, on the loons and preserving them? What were some things that surprised you?
Well, first of all is, how long-lived these birds are. We don't yet know what their full lifespan is, but we have some of the oldest loons in the country right here in New Hampshire, up on Lake Umbegog. So they're a long-lived bird, and also just how, in a way, how much like we humans are when it comes to caring for their young and stuff like that. I do want to point out to listeners that the LPC recommends we don't want to get too close to the loons when you're out there kayaking. You like to stay at least 150 feet away. But even at that distance, you can gather a lot. And, we're heading right now into prime breeding season. The loons have just returned. And, you know, so we all have to be vigilant. But watching them interact and they're kind of their family units, the birds themselves are stunning. You know, they don't have stunning courtship rituals or anything like that. But their family units are certainly very interesting. Their longevity is another thing that I think is quite fascinating.
How long can some of the loons that we know about live?
Yeah, you know, well, there's loons that have been banded at a very young age, and we know they're at least, you know, somewhere approaching 30 years old.
Wow.
So that's pretty high up there when we consider your typical Canada goose or a mallard or something
right.
like that.
And you mentioned the mating season coming. What's an average size loon family? Will they have two or three or more? How does that work? Nesting, of course,
well,
probably close to the shore, I imagine, right on the shore?
Yeah, well, they nest very close to the shore. You know, loons are primarily a water bird, but they do go on shore to nest. It's really important for kayakers, canoeists to, you know, be real careful around those lake or pond shorelines because you can unwittingly flush them. But, you know, the loon mother will typically may lay, you know, one or two eggs. And if we're lucky, you know, one of them survives. So they're very fragile species. They're on the, you know, threatened list here in New Hampshire. The LPC has done a great job with their artificial nest rafting programs and things like that to expand their numbers. But they're still a threatened species. You mentioned the lead sinkers. If you're a fisherman, you know, fishing season started April 1st. Get the lead out. Don't use lead gear. Use something else, titanium, whatever. But yeah, we're just now coming into our loon season here in New Hampshire, and it's important to remember this is where they come to breed, and then they leave. So their time here is kind of fleeting in a way.
Where do they head, Glenn?
They head to the ocean.
Yeah,
yeah, they head to.
Well, you know,
the ocean.
Thank you for saying this. By the way, let me just. Glenn Knobloch, his book, Loons in New Hampshire, Preserving a Natural Treasure. The reason why I asked that is when my smarter, prettier, better half, a number of years ago, I moved over to the coast. And in the off season, I was in that Newcastle, Portsmouth area walking. And I'm a big walker in the afternoons. And I was going by a cove, and I saw a loon or two in the ocean. And it was actually the Piscataqua River. And we were out and about, and we were sitting in one of the great Portsmouth sort of bar restaurants next to some lobstermen in a sports bar. Somehow we got talking, and my wife said jokingly, "Oh, my husband says he's been seeing a lot of loons in the ocean." I told him that's nuts, and of course she's from Minnesota and lakes and loves the outdoors. And they go, "Oh no, we get loons over here all the time in the ocean. That's where they go when they're not on the lakes." And so thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, it's not a far trip for them, but. You know, when they're out there on the ocean, they're in their winter plumage. They're not quite as pretty. They're still a majestic bird, but, you know, we love to see them in their breeding plumage, you know, with their that iridescent red eye and the black and white stunning plumage.
Yeah, the chest, yeah.
That's the sight that every, whether you own a lake place in New Hampshire or you're coming to visit, that's what you hope to see. And so my book really tells everything you need to know about the loon and probably some things you never thought you'd want to know about them, but also the efforts. We can't thank the LPC enough, Harry Vogel and his crew down there, for decades now, well, almost 50 years now, collectively have brought this species back from the brink of loss in New Hampshire to you know, be here for everyone to enjoy as part of our kind of lake life type situation.
Keep up the great work, Glenn. Again, Loons of New Hampshire, Preserving a Natural Treasure. And as an historian living in Wolfboro, have you been able to find Governor Wentworth's coins that he must have fled with when he was leaving there during the Revolutionary times?
No, I haven't. I think he took all those with him. Yeah, just a little, maybe some pottery shards he left behind. No, he took all that with him.
I don't know, though. You know, they were getting out of Dodge pretty quickly. And, of course, Benning Wentworth on the seacoast, too, in Portsmouth. I always wonder what's buried around there in the Wentworth Coolidge Mansion. All right, Glenn, great to have you on.
All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate the attention.
Good Morning, New Hampshire, powered by Sig Sauer. Now, back to Jack Heath on the Pulse of New Hampshire.
You know, sometimes we plan, fortunately, and I didn't think we'd have two interviews this morning on affordable housing and the crisis here and sustainability. And we have Tom Furtado on with our friends from Ketch, right here in the Capital Region, trying to really drive towards affordable housing, rental places, because it's such a challenge and a real, real problem here. And he's talking about April 16th and sustainability and affordable housing and some green energy stuff, Tom. Great to have you back.
Good morning, Jack. Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us about next Monday, Earth Day, and how it's affecting and, you know, ties into properties and technology and housing.
Well, Earth Day is obviously a very important day, and we embrace that here at Catch. And all of our new developments and retrofit of some of our older ones, we try to really incorporate sustainability and green technology into our developments. And that's not anything new for Catch. We've been doing that for years. We have some older properties with solar panels, for example, and our newer ones, we look to use green technology whenever possible.
Talk a little more about the advantage of doing this, not just for efficiency, technology, and the earth, but about housing.
Well, housing affordability, obviously, is the key element to housing these days here in New Hampshire. So any efficient system that we can install that saves operating costs down the road just keeps our rental rates that much lower. So if we can reduce energy use and energy cost for the 10, 15 years in the future, that really helps with rental rates.
And again, people not familiar with Ketch, let's go back to some basics, Tom, not just next Monday, but where, when, website, what's available, what you're working on. I don't think, by the way, I'm not seeing signs that this affordability or lack of it is getting any better, Tom.
I agree with that. Yeah, so Catch Housing, we are here in Concord, and we really serve the Merrimack County area of New Hampshire. And what we do, Jack, is we develop, construct, and then manage affordable residential units throughout Merrimack County. We currently have a portfolio of approximately 400 apartments in Merrimack County, and we're looking to do a couple others. We have one under construction right now. People may know it on Sheep Davis Road here in Concord, and that's going to be 48 units of affordable housing, and we expect to have that complete by year end.
Yeah, that's amazing. What about other areas? I know in the past we've had Rochester, Dover, home builders listening, or, you know, property apartment owners. How do you grow? How do you work with people, whether it's Lakes Region, Seacoast? Tell us about that a little bit.
So Catch has some sister organizations throughout the state. There's a couple developers over on the Seacoast, like the Housing Partnership. We have NeighborWorks Southern New Hampshire down in the Manchester area. We have Lakes Region Community Developers in the Lakes Region, and an organization called AHEAD, and they're up in Littleton. So together, we really work as a team to cover the entire state to develop quality, affordable housing.
So it is collaborative. It's not just to Merrimack or Capital Region.
Absolutely not. We all work together to make sure there's safe, affordable housing throughout the state. Catch, who's been in existence since 1989, we really concentrate on the Merrimack County area.
You know, before we let you go, Tom, I'd be remiss. How did it all get going? How did it start? How long have you been doing it? And how can someone else in a different part of the state sort of mimic or learn from what you've done on the model?
Well, Catch was started by some community leaders here in Concord back in 1989 who saw the writing on the wall that affordable housing was really needed. So they got together and formed Catch, a 501c3 nonprofit, and that's how the journey began, where we develop and maintain safe, affordable housing for the citizens of New Hampshire.
Well, that's it's good stuff. And again, the website to learn more, Tom?
Catchhousing.org. And please go to that website. You'll learn about our existing portfolio, our new developments coming online, as well as how you can apply to rent an apartment.
Good stuff. No catch at all, right, Tom?
No catch at all. Exactly, Jack.
All right, buddy. Happy Earth Day. Thank you, Tom.